Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to Straight Down the Middle here on Love Sport Radio, the finest golf show you ever could find. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed, senior teaching professional at Stoke Park Golf and Country Club, and Jeremy Dale, who is a PGA coach and switch-hitting trick shot artist. You join us in the midst of a fantastic summer of golf. We've seen sensational stories emerge from the Masters and, of course, the PGA Championship. But Tom, which of those two competitions captured your imagination most?
For me, it's the Masters. The first tournament I ever watched on television as an 11-year-old was a 97 Masters, and Tiger Woods hitting 320-yard drives, fist-pumping eagle putts. And 22 years later, I sit there watching him rolling back the years after everything he's been through, numerous injuries, back fusion. I mean, the guy's back winning major championships again, and it was just so poetic. The 22-year lifespan that I've had in the game has been bookended by Tiger Woods winning the Masters in 97 and again this year in 19.
Extraordinary stuff. An extraordinary story as well, because even for the non-golfers amongst us, that narrative of someone being potentially an all-time great, having all sorts of controversy, going off the boil as a sportsman and then coming back, I think engaged the world, if not just the golfing world. Does the PGA Championship keep up with that for you, Jeremy?
Well, I would look more at the courses, which are the stage on which the players perform. The players at the moment are amazing. There is almost a golden age of professional golf, a bit like the 1980s, when there was so many great players. They all played in different styles back then, and they do now. We've got guys like Bubba Watson, who creates. We've got the mechanic, which is Bryson DeChambeau. We've got Dustin Johnson, who plays with a really shut club face. We've got Brooks Koepka, who hits the ball straight in miles. We've got Tiger on the comeback. There's so many great players. They never fail to entertain. What interested me was the dullness and the lack of excitement on the PGA Championship compared to the fascination of the Masters. And I would say that the stage had a big role to play in that. Masters is set up with short grass, no rough at all, and a very strategic design. They didn't have it quite as firm and fast as they normally would, but the PGA was almost the complete opposite. And Masters was set up to allow golfers to play and recover. The PGA was set up with narrow fairways, really thick rough on the outsides, and greens that were sort of circles of green in a sea of rough, and nobody else could play unless they boomed the ball miles. No surprise that Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka, who are the longest, straightest drivers, finished one and two, because it was a course that really over-rewarded long straight driving, and I thought it was less of a spectacle because of the setup of the courses.
Tom, would you subscribe to that idea? Do you think that golf is rewarding the big hitters too much? And is it more engaging as a viewer to watch them have to get a little bit cleverer?
Absolutely, and that's the benefit of the Masters. You know, the natural runoffs and undulations of the greens. We've grown familiar with the pin positions they have on the Sundays, and we know where players need to place the ball in order to make birdies. Whereas Bethpage Black absolutely just went straight into the hands of Koepka and Johnson, as Jeremy said. Koepka, there's never been a better advertisement of using the gym and hitting the ball hard out of thick rough. You know, he was able to control his ball out of thick rough and land it on the greens, and ultimately he'd had the tournament won on Thursday and Friday. He just had to hold on for the rest of the weekend.
And one of the illustrations of the strategic nature of the course was on number 12 on the final day, where the whole thing fell apart for four guys who went in the water. And Woods had the brains and also the luck to not have the honour on that short 12th hole. And it's a really interesting hole, and one of the holes at Tom's course is very similarly designed. It's a par 3 where the green sits at a diagonal to the line of play. So if you go to the right, it's a longer carry. If you go to the left, it's a shorter carry. And what Woods did, he went between the two bunkers in the middle of the green so that if he did hit long or short, he would not be in the water. And everybody else, there were four guys that went into the water. And
a bit too gung-ho.
Well, yes, but it's the nature of the course that did that, and there was no rough on the bank of the water to stop the ball, as there would have been at the PGA, and I just think that the risk reward nature of those holes benefited the spectacle as a whole in an amazing way, as it always does. And the PGA, they just got it, I think, completely wrong. And it's a bad example for people watching at home with their courses. They think, oh, the rough has to be thick, and the thick rough around the green so that nobody can chip. I saw Ian Poulter on a 500-yard par 4 miss the green with a rescue by a yard and have almost no lie at all. And if you take away the skills of chipping and recovery shots, then you have no Seve chip-ins, you have no Phil Mickelsons out of the woods hitting amazing recovery shots to 3 feet. You strip away all of that and you over-reward the big hitter, and I don't like that. I think that's a really bad trend for professional golf.
And I think Jeremy's absolutely right, and that's what makes the 12th hole at Augusta so unique and so special. It's unravelled Jordan Spieth's epic meltdown a couple of years ago, and it was the start of Molinari's meltdown this year. He played 54 holes of tournament golf at Augusta National without a drop shot, which is phenomenal. And Jeremy's absolutely right. Tiger had the experience to bring the ball flight down, put it into the centre of the green. Molinari went high and for the flag. He got caught in the caught short in the water, and the tournament switched right on that hole.
But explain this for some of our listeners, because not everyone who's with us now is going to be a golfing expert. I can see this both ways, right? Because I completely appreciate that rewarding clever golf, tactical golf, is more dramatic. It's perhaps more compelling as a viewer. But how hard is it to hit it really long? You made a comment about Koepka getting in the gym and being able to launch it. Surely there's technique involved. This can't be that easy, or they'd all have it in their locker.
Absolutely right. I think Tiger, he was asked the question early in his career, you know, why do you train? Because back then, players weren't training in the gym. And his theory was, why don't you give the golfer with the most skill in the world an athlete's body? You know, then, well, ironically, you should be more injury prevention, but also you'll be able to hit the ball further. And with Koepka hitting the ball much further down the holes than other players, there's less relevance on hitting the ball in the fairway, because he can hit a sandwich from thick rough, whereas a shorter hitter could hit it 7-iron from the fairway. And arguably, you could say that hitting a sandwich out of rough is easier than hitting the 7-iron from the middle of the fairway.
Is this going to change the complexion of golf as a sport? When people see the likes of Koepka, the likes of Johnson, who wasn't too far off him, just 6 under, excelling on courses that, as you guys have both pointed out, play into the hands of bigger hitters, are we going to see young kids coming through placing more of an emphasis on being able to launch the ball massive distances?
They already are. There was an RNA report this year that came out, which showed the increases in distance that players were hitting it. And the ones that were longest of all were the guys on the web.com tour, which is the second tier tour in the United States. They hit the ball even further than the pros. So this isn't going to stop unless the RNA and the USGA actually do something about it. And there's been talk of a rollback in the distance that the ball goes for years. I mean, Jack Nicklaus has been talking about this for 25 years. Gary Player the same. In fact, anybody who has designed a golf course talks about the fact that the minute they design it, it's pretty well obsolete. Even Tiger mentioned it in his book some years ago, I think 10, 12 years ago. And it's amazing to me that all the best players aren't saying, yeah, the ball goes too far, because it's in their interest to be hitting 4-iron into a par 4, hitting wood into a par 5 instead of 7-iron or wedge respectively, because that's a place where they can show their skill. If everybody's hitting a short iron, there is no differentiator. The longer the shot, the more skillful you've got to be to execute it properly. So the best players should be calling for a rollback, and they're not, partly because I think they're all in, they're all sponsored by the equipment manufacturers, so they're actually not in their interest to do that. And the game is professional. I mean, for the amateurs, it's great. The good drivers go nice and easy to hit. It's never been easier to play golf. But the thing about it is, the professional game, you can't take these championships to classic courses like Merion without doctoring them and taking them away from what they were originally intended to be. It's a real dilemma.
What's the solution?
I mean, some of the best tournaments are now played on some of the shorter and tougher golf courses. You think of some of the most famous holes in golf. You know, I think to hole 7. At Pebble Beach, I think to the road hole at St Andrews. You know, I just think some of the holes have character and aren't necessarily based on guys hitting the ball 350. I think some of the tournaments that Rory McIlroy has played, he's hitting the ball anywhere between 330 and 370 now, which means Augusta has changed substantially. When the players walk off at a green at Augusta, they have to walk back 150 yards to get to the new tee boxes to start the hole again. Golf courses are catering for longer hitters now.
So on that, I'm privileged to be joined by you two in the studio, not just in the sense that you're both excellent golfers, but you're also excellent golf educators. When you're taking on new students of any age, what do you focus on? Is it getting to a point where you're following the trend and going, here's how you ping it?
Oh, no, I'm not doing that. the way to get a golfer the way to get somebody excited about golf is to teach them from the hole backwards. So any new golfer, whoever it is, male, female, kid, old person, doesn't matter, take them putting. Because all you got to do is give them a putter and a ball and say, well, come back in 2 minutes and tell me whether speed or line is more important. And they'll go away and they'll have a few putts and they'll hit the first one 10 yards too far and the second one 5 yards too short. And they'll come back and go, yeah, it's distance. So right, how do we control that? And then, of course, once they've got that a bit under control, they find that holing out from even from a foot or 2 foot is quite unpredictable. And so they're already interested in the game. And putting is a very low barrier to entry. Anybody can do it. But once you've done that, you can go, right, we're going to have 9 holes. You can explain the game. You can take all the jargon away in literally half an hour and make them into somebody who's interested in golf and has had a lovely experience with the game that isn't about looking at a hole which is 440 yards long yeah, with a driver and go, okay, I can't play this game. And so you don't dumb it down, you simplify it.
Interesting stuff.
And I think with a shorter swing, a chipping swing and a putting motion, you can learn how to put club to ball. You know, it's very difficult to address the ball, take the club up and around behind your head and then return it to the golf ball first time out. So it's very important to do the short, small swings first to learn how to connect and strike. And then the point of it also is learning what is the game about. The game is about getting the ball in the hole. And we start with chipping and putting, and then we move them onto short holes on the golf course so they understand what is the point of all of the practice work that they do on the driving range.
And that's how Tiger learned. He talks about learning from the hole backwards, not the tee forwards. And it's a much more interesting way to go about it.
I think it's fascinating that this conversation has reached a point where we're discussing interests and we're discussing excitement. And arguably, there's never been a better point to be excited about golf. It's not just because of this exceptional generation of golfers we've got to watch. It's also because of clever management at the governing body level. We've seen some scheduling changes which could make this summer one of the finest summers of golf ever. Don't go anywhere.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to Straight Down the Middle here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. And we've seen some scheduling changes to the golfing calendar. It's not a sentence that sounds exceptionally exciting, but actually, it's leading to really good things in the sport.
Exactly. The season has been compressed by the authorities moving the PGA Championship from August, when it was always taken to sort of southern states and it was always amazingly humid and hot, and they put it into May, which was previously a dead month. So now there's something happening every month from March. You've got the TPC, the Tournament Players Championship, with the Island Green, that's at Sawgrass, with the 17th. It's not a major, but it's the next best thing, with arguably the strongest field in golf, and that kicks the season off in March. Then you've got April, which is the Masters, which is always at the same golf course and always an exciting start to the season. Then the PGA in May, then the US Open is coming up next week, and then we've got the Open Championship in July, and it compresses the season. I always think that's a good thing. Look at other sports, they don't go all year, and the interest wane. They have a compressed period, and they've done this so that the PGA Championship doesn't conflict too much with the start of the American football season. And I think it's really helped golf, because now the focus is on this 4 month period where you've got the four majors. I think it's miles better.
Absolutely. And one thing that I'm thinking about is, what is Brooks Koepka going to do after the Open Championship?
Go back to the gym.
Is it the off-season for him? Is he just going to put his feet up now until next April and get ready for the next major? Because this guy just performs at a very high level during major championships. But, you know, following on from what Jeremy said, I think it's fantastic concentrating all of the major events at the start of the season. You know, things get really exciting in professional golf in April when the Masters starts. It's the season here in the UK and everybody wants to pick up their clubs and get out and start playing. But now that the tours, we're starting to get this world tour structure now. Players are able, they want the big players in the main events in both Europe and the US, and they're having to schedule accordingly to make sure that happens.
Is there any potential for that to lead to perhaps the smaller events being underrepresented in terms of star names?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, obvious one to go there is Rory McIlroy missing the Irish Open this year. You know, there's a lot of pressure on him to do that. And you could argue that maybe it is his responsibility as the most famous Irish golfer, you know, in the game to be there. But it's very difficult for these guys. They have busy schedules. They want to win major championships and world championships. And if these smaller events don't work into the schedule for them, then they're going to have to be selfish and not play them.
It's not the end of the season in July when the Open Championship finishes, don't forget. In alternate years, we've got the Ryder Cup. There's also the FedEx Cup, and if you can explain how that works to me, then great. and there's the race to Dubai. So there are significant tournaments, and they certainly get the interest of the players. The season-ending tournaments are worth lots of cash, and the players are still engaged in that. But I think it's really good for the general fan to have, and for the media to have, this focus on golf for this shorter period rather than having to drag it out. I just think it's much better.
It also leads to a more condensed focus on the players. One name that we keep coming back to is Brooks Koepka, not just, of course, because he won the PGA Championship. How good is he in relation to the really big names of golf at the moment?
Well, he doesn't have the same pedigree as some of the guys, like, you know, the guys that go through the collegiate system and win the US amateur and the British amateur, and they follow a trajectory that moves them into the top 10 in the world. Koepka started with very humble beginnings as a Challenge Tour player, which is the second tier, the tier below the European Tour. So he came to Europe to learn his trade, and he's got very good very quickly. You know, he hasn't had that Walker Cup college experience.
How unusual is that?
It's very unusual for an American to come to Europe and play the Challenge Tour. They all go to the web.com tour, but I think it's been the making of him as a player. He's always a really strong player, but to experience all the different conditions, and they're less than perfect for golf, but not perfectly manicured, and there's a difference. All those different conditions that you experience in Europe, less good weather, more difficult circumstances, different languages, travel, I think that's stood him in really good stead.
Yeah, no, I think it's made him, you know, mentally very strong. You know, there was the raucous New York crowd at Bethpage were chanting choke at him in the last six holes of the tournament. And, you know, when he was interviewed at the end of the round, they asked him if it put him off, and he said, well, to be honest, I was choking, so they were right. You know, this guy is unflappable. I mean, he is the ultimate Iceman. I think this guy is going to get himself into double digits for major championships and get his name up there with the greats.
Well, it's quite a shout. Is there snobbery in golf about the route you take to the top? This is something we see a lot in football, where there are some players who are rated from the age of 15 as a world star, and then you get some, like current England captain Harry Kane, who aren't tipped as big, big names and suddenly come out of nowhere. And you always feel that from the Wayne Rooneys of this world, there's a slight element of, why didn't I play you as a boy?
Absolutely. I mean, Poulter was famously quoted as saying, listen, I wasn't a Silver Spoon Walker Cup player. and what that means is that he wasn't one of the top-ranked amateurs in the world. But when he turned pro, he became very good very quickly. And I don't think it matters anymore. I think a lot of players tend to peak between the age of 30 and 40 now. So I don't think it's integral that you have an amazing junior and amateur career.
No, absolutely not. I mean, there are plenty of examples of late developers, and you've named one really good one, Ian Poulter. But your scores tell the story. I mean, that's why you're there. You're a professional golfer, so if your scores aren't up to it, you're not going to be around for very long. Mm. And I think sport is very egalitarian, actually. I don't see golf... I mean, maybe you used to be in rugby and cricket, that if you went to a private school, that you would have access to... I mean, it's purely about access to... You know, the clubs and you'd have access to cricket itself. Whereas if you went to maybe a comprehensive, they wouldn't play cricket. I mean, those kinds of sports, I could understand it. But with golf, if you're good enough, then, you know, then your scores will show it.
And on that, has there been anyone who isn't perhaps already a star name, who in your experience watching the PGA Championship this year, the Masters this year, has stood out as a potential star of the future?
Well, I know Tom likes Jaz Janawaternond, but he can't say the name, so I'll say it for him. I mean, Jaz had a fantastic PGA, didn't have a great finish, finished 7-over for the last round, but he was excellent, and I love the way he played as well, because it's not really a textbook swing. So he's already won, and he's definitely one to look forward to, forward to his progress. In terms of players that haven't been on the radar that much, I liked Danny Willett, again former Masters champion. He won a big tournament in Dubai at the end of the last season, the Race to Dubai, and I liked what he was doing because he's on the comeback trail. And he's been away for a long time. So it was nice to see him having two good major tournaments.
And also Matt Wallace. You know, Matt Wallace, I've played golf with Matt Wallace in mini tour level only 5 years ago. And now he sits in there in the top 30 of the world rankings. His trajectory has been phenomenally quick. He's now a four-time winner on the European Tour. He's contending on the global stage. He was the guy that was fighting out for third place. You know, that the Koepka and Johnson show that it became on Sunday afternoon. Matt Wallace was in there winning his own mini tournament in third place. I think that we're going to see a lot more of Matt Wallace in the major events. He has a great, great confidence game.
And you know, the other guy that I actually had, he was going to be my pick for the US Open, but he's just ruined it by winning the Memorial yesterday. It was Patrick Cantlay. I thought there was a guy, again, who was doing really well in the majors and in all the other tournaments, numerous top tens this year. And a guy who played less of a power game, actually, more of an accuracy game. And I just thought he looked really good and obviously won yesterday, but I was going to pick him for a US Open, and he may still do that. Also look for a resurgence of Jordan Spieth, who's found his putting touch and his mad scrambling skills. Did really well at both Bethpage and the Memorial on courses that take away the chipping skill by having thick rough around the green, so not courses that you'd think would suit him, but madly scrapping away as he was at his best.
And Cantlay, doing some research on him, he was ranked world number one amateur for 55 weeks, which is a phenomenal stat. I mean, this guy, you know, you could put him in the Silver Spoon Walker Cup category. You know, he was the top college player. And, you know, with his record, he's had a lot of injury problems early on in his career. But I agree with Jeremy. He's another man to watch for majors this year.
He had a terrible back injury. He was laid low for 2 years and a personal tragedy as well. He was involved in not directly involved, but he was witnessed his caddy getting run over on a hit and run, and the guy died. And it was just awful 3 years for him. And, you know, he's a very serious young man. You can kind of understand with that backstory why he is. But hats off to him. He was amazing at the Memorial, and he's played beautifully all year, and I think he's one to really watch.
Wonderful few tips for future golfing stars of the future. But when the media are engaging with professional golfers, they engage with two things. They engage firstly with your golfing ability, of course, but secondly with your personality. We see some who are very popular, some who are perhaps the villains of the piece. But coming up, it's time to find out how far a smile can get you.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to Straight Down the Middle here on Love Sport Radio, the finest golf show you will find on radio, with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. And a few months ago, well, call it a year, Matt Kuchar was one of the most popular men on the golfing circuit. He was thought of as one of the really popular guys, a good guy, as it were, always smiling, always seen as a good bloke. And he sort of got it a bit wrong.
It's not been a good year for Matt Kuchar. And I think his agent, Steinberg, who is also representing Tiger Woods, has probably got a few grey hairs over the last few years. Matt Kuchar started off the year with the caddy incident, where he won $1.2 million and paid his caddy a $5,000 fee.
Talk us through this argument, because his defence at the time was that was the fee they'd agreed before. Was it a case of they'd agreed that it would be $5,000 regardless of his place, or that was what he would get of the purse?
They agreed it would be $3,000 and he gave him a $2,000 bonus.
Oh, and what a good guy.
The issue there, you know, players, you know, caddies will be in a 10% win commission. And they settled on 5% in the end. But ultimately, it was a missed opportunity for Kuchar from a publicity point of view to change someone's life. You know, this guy is a local caddy in Mexico. He's an agronomist, but he has to caddy because being an agronomist doesn't earn him a good enough living to support his family. So in the end, he asked for $50,000, which was at the 5% mark, and he was granted that at the end. But the public image of Kuchar was damaged at that point.
Also, forgive me for being a cynical journalist, but he didn't just miss an opportunity to change a man's life, which is obviously the biggest point. He also missed an opportunity to really boost his own public image and perception, and it actually would have been worth more than a lot of money, $50,000, another $100,000 in terms of ad revenue, even if you're just thinking financially. Bad decision.
Well, put into context, Kuchar's career earnings are in the region of $46 million, which makes it look even worse, really, when you think about it. And but the thing about it is, I mean, a contract is a contract. If he agreed three and gave five, he's done actually nothing wrong by the letter of the law, but as you both rightly say, the spirit. and the opportunity to look good or to do the right thing at least was completely missed, and he's just kept missing it ever since.
How often do we see these contracts broken? I know Kuchar has, as you say, not had a best year in other senses, but just quickly on the caddies, how often does the amount get under or overpaid? And actually, how important is the caddy to how likely you are to succeed?
Caddy's hugely important. And it's not telling the player how to hit the shot, because the player knows how to do that. It's saying the right thing at the right time and not saying the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Not saying choke.
Correct. Yeah. And in this circumstance, I think the local caddy, I mean, he had great knowledge of the course because he walks it every day. That's his job. He also, I think, made Matt Kuchar really relaxed during the week. And I think there was a huge contribution to Matt Kuchar's victory there.
So you give him a tip?
Absolutely, yeah. More than $2,000. Ironically, the following week in Riviera, he made a cheque for exactly $50,000, which was the exact sum of money that he ended up having to pay him.
I'm not saying anything.
Well, no, caddying is something I have done. My first job in golf was as a caddy at the Open Championship. I caddied for a guy who made all four rounds. It was a fantastic experience. But you can make a big difference, especially if you get things wrong. And these guys paid a lot of money. And the Kuchar's caddy in Mexico was a one-off. It was a week assignment. It wasn't a normal contracted caddy where everything would be taken care of by the agent. This was just a one-week thing. And I would imagine that Kuchar went down there not thinking that he was going to do that well. And his form hadn't been great. And suddenly he ends up winning. And that's obviously... Yeah, thrown him. I mean, these guys live in a bit of a bubble, as you can imagine, and nobody's told him, and he hasn't realised, and it's all a very, very bad look. And yeah, he's not the first time either.
And one of the most experienced agents in the business, Steinberg, I can't believe that he's missed that opportunity with Matt Kuchar there. You know, he could have made a story about it.
He did make a story about
it.
But in the wrong direction. And that isn't where Kuchar's year ended badly in a PR point of view, certainly. Where was the next slip-up?
Well, number two on the list, which confirmed his removal for most popular player of the year award, was not conceding a very short putt whilst playing against Sergio Garcia in the Dell match play in Austin, Texas.
So he said, you have to do it.
Garcia missed a putt to win the hole. Kuchar walked off the green without saying, hey, go ahead, pick that one up. Garcia picks the ball up, hole gets conceded. So there's another faux pas there from Kuchar, is really that the putt is conceded because it's only 2 inches away from the hole. But because he didn't concede it, Garcia loses the hole.
Yeah, I think Garcia has a big role to play in this, though. I mean, these guys have been professional golfers for ages. They've played golf all their lives.
Are you saying he shouldn't pick the ball up?
He should not pick the ball up. Absolutely not. So Garcia is as much to blame. Neither needed this. I mean, Garcia was just coming off smashing up a bunker in Saudi Arabia. And neither player wanted this to happen. And they did that really cringy video where they pretended to be mates again. And I would say the guy that started that is actually Sergio. I mean, everybody knows that if you're going to pick a ball up, you ask your opponent if it's good, even if it is 2 inches. I wouldn't make that mistake. And I wouldn't expect Sergio to do it either. And
do you think he knew what he was doing?
Who, Garcia? Or?
Yeah, do you think that Garcia was thinking, well, hang on a minute, I picked this up, he looks bad.
No.
I think it was an act of haste.
No.
He was upset, he missed the putt.
Right.
He grabbed the ball, agree with Jeremy, hugely, you know, for him to blame. And I think that the rules didn't allow Kuchar to actually concede the hole or concede the half.
Right, because he retrospectively wanted to do so, didn't he?
He said, I didn't concede it and I don't know how to handle this. As soon as you say that... You have to bring in the referee, and the referee, as Thomas rightly said, is going to say, "Well, you can't retrospectively concede a putt, so you didn't give it, so it's loss of hole."
Why can't you?
It's the rule.
Bizarre.
I know.
Bizarre.
Well, that's golf. Yeah, the rules are a bit weird sometimes, but in this, I think Garcia was the one who started this thing off a little bit. And
I see.
Yes, Kuchar maybe didn't handle it that particularly well, but you've got to give each player equal credit for the mess that they got themselves into.
Yeah, Kuchar, not entirely to blame. Please tell me that that is where his poor year from a PR point of view ended. Please.
Oh, no. Well, actually, before even those two things, we'd had him horribly snubbing Andrew Coltart, who wanted an interview at a tournament last year. And he just wouldn't talk to him at all. I think it was at the Open Championship.
It was indeed.
And he just looked really bad. I mean, that, you know, you're just messing around. He's not doing anything. It's a practice round. No reason at all for him not to give Andrew Cole. And Koechat interviews really nicely as well. He's interesting and talks in a considered way. It's not a question of mouth open, brain and neutral with him. You actually get some interesting stuff out of him, and he seems really nice. And so that was that thing. And then yesterday, last week at the memorial, his ball landed on a fairway, bounced up, and then rolled into somebody else's pitch mark. Now, the memorial, the fairways were pretty soft, so you had these balls landing in the fairway and taking lumps out of the grass. Anyway, Kuchar's ball rolled into that, and it was quite clear that it had rolled into it. So he calls over the referee and says, yeah, I think this is an embedded ball. Now, if you get an embedded ball where it's embedded under its own steam, free drop.
Right.
If it rolls into somebody else's mark or into a divot equally, then that's no relief. You don't. And he was trying to argue. Yeah, the ball had bounced up and added to the pitch mark or the depth of the pitch mark that was already there. And he got a referee over, and the referee said, no, that's, you've got to play that. And he could actually get to the back of the ball, no problem. It wasn't actually as badly embedded as you might imagine. And he said, oh, can I have a second opinion? So he got another referee, and the referee went, well, no, I've seen it already. An English guy, Stephen Cox, he was brilliant. He handled it beautifully.
Very polite.
He was polite. But quite threatening. He didn't say, no, Matty, I'm sorry, I'd love to give you a drop, but I can't. He said, no, come on, play it, and left him at that. And then Kuchar said, well, can I get a third opinion?
Oh, Lord above, hang on a minute.
Yeah, no.
Is this guy just a diva? Is that what's going on? Has he won X amount of money, X amount of competitions, and has just decided that he's bigger than everybody else?
Well, you do wonder. I mean, you know, he's had more top tens than most guys will ever have in their career. I mean, this guy's a cash machine, $40+ million. He's a US amateur champion.
I've heard his caddy's loaded as well.
Wait, well,
we'd like to see that contract, even if there is a contract. Who knows? But, you know, I think that he has this persona on the golf course, this huge smile. And he comes across as a very warm and genuine guy. I'm not saying he's not, because I've never met Matt Kuchar, but his actions this season on the golf course have not been good.
Yeah, he's just not helping himself, and he plays in an interesting way too. I mean, he has what they call now a one plane swing. You can sort of see from the height of his left arm in the backswing that it's very low, almost the same level or below the level of his shoulders. Complete contrast to a guy like Bubba Watson, who has a very high hand. And Colin Montgomery played that way. Greg Norman played that way. And there's so many great players at the moment that play in different ways, and he was one that was really individual and really unique. And I always like watching that, and I always like listening to him. And I can't really understand where he's coming from with all this weird stuff that he's carrying on with.
I think we've heard a lot about how experienced his agent is. It sounds to me like his agent needs to have a word. Someone just needs to say, "Come on, let's just calm down a bit. It's not the end of the world." Not the only man who's been making faux pas in a golfing context, though. Coming up, I'm afraid we've got to talk about Hank Haney.
This is Love Sport.
This is a big summer for women's sport. It's a big summer for equality in terms of perception of sport. Not only have we got serious activity in the women's golfing game, we've also got a Women's World Cup coming up in Paris. England with a good chance there, of course. Everyone getting behind them. We do, of course, have a women's football show right here on Love Sport Radio every Friday evening, 7 till 8. So for all of your sporting fix, get on to that one. But we're going to talk about women's golf here, because Hank Haney, who is obviously a huge figure in the game, has made some rather ill-advised comments. So he has still just about a radio show on Sirius XM. It's a PGA Tour radio show, and he made a couple of comments that were ill-advised. He was asked first who he thought would win the competition. He said he would predict a Korean, that's a quotation, I would predict a Korean to win the event, and said, I couldn't name you like six players on the LPGA Tour. So dismissive and dangerously close to the holy duopoly, if you like, of both racism and sexism in one interview.
Absolutely right. I mean, you know, I think he forgot who he is and how much of an influential figure he is in the world of golf. You know, he coached one of the greatest players that's ever played the game. He's worked with ladies on the LPGA as well. And he showed a huge lack of respect with those comments towards a ladies' game. He even cited that he didn't even know where the venue was at. And his job is to help promote not do the opposite. And I think it was very insulting. And he got a huge backlash on social media from some famous names, including Michelle Wee, who's one of the big figures in ladies' golf. She said that, you know, it made it very disappointing and angered me on so many different levels. Racism and sexism are no laughing matter, Hank. Shame on you. I don't ever do this, but this must be called out. Mm. And Hank Haney then apologized publicly, as he should have done. And then, I don't know why.
He doubled down, didn't he?
He doubled down. Absolutely.
He doubled down. So the comment he'd made beforehand was that he would simply have to go with Lee as the name if he were asked to name a name. He said, I couldn't name a first name. And because, of course, the competition was won by Jungkook Lee, he's now come out and said, well, look, I was right, as if that's the point.
Yeah, I mean, he's just... He's digging a deeper and deeper hole for himself. I can't believe he's done that. There could be an ego thing in there for him. You know, he probably doesn't like the fact that he's been told off by so many people in the industry and fans of the game. And he's decided to tell everyone that he was right in the first place and he didn't mean anything by it, which is totally the wrong thing. He's probably got Steinberg managing him as well, I guess.
Yeah, I find it astonishing that a guy who does a radio show and is supposed to be an informed part of the media wouldn't even know where the Ladies US Open is being played.
Do you think he did know where it was being played and he was being flippant about the whole thing?
Hard to say, but you don't, like Tom said, you don't treat the ladies' game with such a lack of respect that you boast about ignorance of it. That's just stupid. And Tiger actually weighed in as well with saying, well, what do you think of Hank Haney's banning? He said, well, he got what he deserved. He deserved exactly that. And so there's no love from Tiger and no surprise really on that because after he split from Haney, Haney wrote a pretty insightful and not overly nice book called The Big Miss about his relationship with Tiger. So first chance Tiger gets revenge served up nice and cold.
Absolutely, that was karma. And I read both books. So when Tiger went through his off-course antics, Steve Williams, his caddy, and Hank Haney, his coach, were both gone at that point. They both wrote books. And Hank Haney's book and Steve Williams' book were totally different. I think Hank Haney went in with a lot of low blows and passed a lot of blame onto Tiger, saying that he did a wonderful job and it was all Tiger's fault, etc. Whereas Steve Williams had a far more professional approach. And I don't think Steve Williams has lost any of Tiger's respect, or I think Hank has lost all of Tiger's respect.
Right. This strikes me as another example of quite a few that we've addressed so far, bearing in mind we're 43 minutes into our first show. We've already covered quite a few people in golf who, whether or not they're actually unpleasant people, just seem to have a really bad or indeed non-existent eye for the faux pas, for being impolite, ignorant, rude. Is this a consistent problem or are there just a couple of idiots?
I think there's a couple of idiots and it's certainly not the press that golf needs. Golf is a fantastically sociable game and a game that's rich in tradition and heritage. And I think that it's just what makes good news sometimes. And I think there's a few guys out there that have done some things that they would probably regret and it makes for a good news story. But ultimately, the game is full of wonderful ambassadors and we've got some great young ones coming through in both Europe and the US.
And in terms of the attitude within golf to the ladies' game, where are we? Is there still a lot of sexism? Are things moving in the right direction?
You know, they're lacking prize money, they're lacking sponsorship for their events. It's far more fruitful for ladies to compete in the US than in Europe. At the moment, there is obviously, there's been a mixed event with male seniors, male tour players and lady players, which went really well. And I think that sort of thing is going to start happening more and more. The equal prize money conversation is probably one for another day. But, you know, I think ladies golf is in a good place. There's a huge talent pool coming out of Asia for ladies golf at the moment. And, you know, I think the future is bright for them, but they could really do with more press, more sponsorship to make their events bigger.
The Ladies European Tour definitely is struggling and there's new management there to try and raise prize money. I mean, in the American Tour, prize money is pretty amazing. I mean, we just had the Ladies US Open, which, you know, we could probably talk about now, which was played for the record at the Country Club of Charleston, which is a Seth Rayner course, an old style design, really undulating greens, interesting golf course. And the prize money was $5 million, $1 million to the winner. And it was won by Jungkook Lee, six, so named because there are six players on the Korean on six Korean players of the same name. She's only 23. She's got an interesting backstory. She's playing golf so that she can benefit her family, and her father is disabled. And she played amazingly well. Rounds of 70, 69, 69 and 70, won by two. But it was a fascinating tournament. I have to feel sorry for Céline Boutier from France. She finished in fifth place. And she'd led pretty well all the way. And then she got overtaken halfway through the back nine. And she had a tiny little putt on the 16th to make a birdie, just as Lee Six was bogeying the last. That would have brought them together. And then she doubled the last hole as well. But there was it was really quite an exciting tournament, and I think a lot of amateurs could learn a huge amount from watching how these girls play. They've got great rhythm, they've got great technique, and they are very composed. And I don't know why South Korea is producing so many great players, but they're incredible all the great players are from South Korea. There's a huge number of them. All the great players, that's not quite true, but there's so many, disproportionate number of great lady golfers coming out of that country. I'm very impressed with it. Really amazing.
A golden generation, it seems, in South Korea, certainly for ladies golf. But there are still going to be some people who are discouraged from picking the game up at the earliest level, because they look at people hitting a ball hundreds of yards and they think that looks really, really difficult. They look at Tiger Woods putting from extreme distances on a weird sloping green and go, well, how do you ever do that? And Lee Westwood has come out and said golf is too hard. Is he right?
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to Straight Down the Middle, the golf show here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed and Jeremy Dale. And we got to talk about Lee Westwood's comments. He was asked about the challenges facing golf as a sport, as an industry. He gave a very wide-ranging, varied response. We'll come on to various aspects of it. But the most fundamental point he made is that one of the main things with golf is that it's too hard. He said, we should be trying to make it easier. I think different formats where maybe the hole's bigger, not as much rough on golf courses, so people aren't out there losing golf balls, looking for their golf balls all the time. I think that's part of the problem, that it's a hard game to play. I've got two golfing experts opposite me. Is golf too difficult?
I think it can be, but I think that you need to play a golf course that's relative to your standard, both in setup and length. You know, I don't like the idea of changing the size of the golf hole. I think it's traditional. I think we should leave the golf hole the size it is.
Start playing pool.
Exactly. I mean, foot golf, there's an initiative there that tries to get people, you know, going from five-a-side football into the golf course. But I've just recently returned from the US Kids European Championships, which is for kids age 6 through till 18. And I was out there with a few students that I work with, and they play on a scaled course relative to the distance that they hit the ball.
Right.
So that game of golf for them became enjoyable and a true challenge for their standard.
But a manageable challenge.
Absolutely right. And I think that's where we need to go. We need to make sure that people are playing for the right golf courses that don't have as much rough. I agree with the comment from Westwood there. If we get rid of some rough, that's going to make things a lot easier. But I think the most important thing is that golfers need to be playing from a set of tees that is relative to their standard. And then that can be, I would do that purely on the distance that they hit the ball.
Interesting. Jeremy, I know you've got very strong views on this. What's your take?
Well, I think golf is hard and everybody knows that it's hard, but I don't think it's too hard. I think people want it to be difficult and they understand that when they get into it. And but what I do think is that golf courses are too hard. And they are set up in a misguided way. One of the major complaints, and Lee mentioned this as well, I think, in his interview, is that it takes too long. Well, one of the reasons why it takes too long is that people are looking for golf balls in thick cabbage rough. And also that the greens are so quick that every putt rolls 3-4 feet by. People mark it, read it, go through their whole routine of trying to hole it because it's not dead to the hole. And I think the game could be a lot more interesting if you mowed a load of rough down, had the greens that are a firm texture so that it wasn't splat golf, as I call it, where your ball just pitches and stops, but the ball runs, and the game's much more interesting when it does something once it's landed. It's a better game. People travel from all around the world to play the course, the great links courses of Britain and Ireland. And they do that because it's different kind of terrain that they're playing on. And I think that's one of the most important things, is that the playground that we produce, the stage on which the professionals play, but the playground that the amateurs play on, it gives them as much entertainment as the game itself. What I love about the game is to try and create different shots. So if a ball needs to be hooked around a tree or played low into the wind or a particular fairway moves in one direction or there is a slope that you need to counter, the joy of the game is to create a shot that suits the particular situation. Now, if the courses are too penal, then all of that joy goes away and people start to think of it as simply a test of, can I just hit the ball straight between those two goalposts every time? And the idea of thinking about what you're doing and where you're going and the idea of strategy is completely eliminated. So I would say courses are, and this is kind of a reaction or an imitation of the PGA Tour's approach sometimes, and they become too penal in their approach. I just think courses are too hard. The game itself is a joy because it's really hard. And, I mean, for 20 years I've been trying to put the fun into golf. And I too was in Scotland last week, actually. And I did a show at a wonderful golf course, Royal Dornoch. And before I did that, at 11 o'clock, I did a kids' clinic where I came and we invited down all the junior section and 35 kids came down. And they all had a go at trick shots. They watched me do a few, and then we invited them to have a go, and they were amazing at it. The shots that we tried were, amongst others, Happy Gilmore and teeing the ball up 2.5 feet up in the air, they loved it. And they went away with the idea that, well, golf is this isn't really like normal golf is. This is amazing. This is fun. They go away with a really positive experience, and we need to put, I mean, I think Lee's point was we need to put the joy and the fun back into it. And that's the key. And the course itself plays a huge role in that. I don't want it dumbed down by a 5-inch hole.
No, just making it accessible.
Yes. And interesting and exciting. That's the point.
With that in mind, I've got a practical exercise for you, gentlemen, because it's time for me to come clean. I'm a big fan of golf. I think it's a fantastic sport. I love watching it. I love talking about it, analysing it. But I cannot for the life of me play the thing. Right, I've tried a couple of times, and it's daunting, as we've discussed. It can be humiliating if you take an enormous swing and only get the ball to travel 20 yards or miss it altogether. If you were dealing with someone like me, who is not a kid, is interested in golf, but is scared to death of making a fool out of themselves, how would you engage me?
I think some of the success that we have at Stoke Park is that we do beginner clinics. Okay, so this is at much lower expense, and you come in a group format, and all like-minded individuals and all beginners learn at the same time together, so it becomes enjoyable.
You're all as rubbish as each other,
exactly.
If we're honest.
So you can all laugh at each other, and you can all grow together as well. And that's exactly how we get kids involved in the game. They don't come for private one-on-one tuition because there's too much expense, and quite frankly, it would be boring for them. So what we do with junior golfers, we have them in groups of anywhere between 4 and 10, and it's all game-based learning.
Wonderful.
So exactly what Jeremy is talking about there is having a go at trick shots. If we as coaches can help children understand that they need to associate the game of golf with fun, they're more likely to come back and play it again. And that is the challenge we face.
That's got to be the solution. And of course, once you've got them engaged, once you've got them improving, the sky is the limit. Some of these guys, some of these girls will go on to play on the professional circuit. And once they get there, it's quite a sport to play. Coming up in the next couple of months, coming up in the next few weeks of shows, we've got some exceptional competitions to cover, some exceptional sportsmen and women to discuss. What's on the agenda?
Well, we've got the US Open coming up in June, and then the Open Championship in July. Those are the second half of the major championship season. And the US Open played at Pebble Beach on the west coast of America. And Tiger's a previous winner there. Tom Watson beat Jack Nicklaus in a famous duel there as well. So great venue, spectacular location. They've got about 6 or 7 holes all along the ocean. And the Open Championship is returning to Northern Ireland for the first time since 1951, where Max Faulkner won it. And that will be a really cool thing for the Open to go to Northern Ireland, obviously.
And McIlroy will be at that one.
He certainly will turn up for that one, hopefully with his A game. And what an amazing thing that would be if he would win it. And Portrush is where Darren Clarke is from. And it's a wonderful links course. I had the pleasure of playing it. Really great links, and they've made a few changes to the course to be able to accommodate the Open Championship and everything that goes with it. But there's nothing wrong with the venues, and they should produce amazing golf. I just hope the USGA don't become the story at the US Open. In the last couple of years, there's been a couple of setup controversies, most notably Phil Mickelson hitting a moving ball to stop it rolling off the green, and then just letting the greens get a bit out of control. As long as the US Open aren't the story and they set it up in a sensible way, then that should be a fine championship as well.
Well, I suspect whatever happens, we're going to have masses of talking points, masses to discuss, and of course, a sensational summer of golf to bring you right here on Love Sport Radio. It is, of course, Straight Down the Middle every Monday night, 7 till 8. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Tom Reed, Senior Teaching Professional at Stoke Park Golf and Country Club, and Jeremy Dale, who's a PGA coach and switch hitting trick shot artist. You'll have to join us next week on Straight Down the Middle.
This is Love Sport. Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.